श्रीये नमो सुश्रीये नमो उच्चमा श्रीये सोह ओ नमो मंजुश्रीये नमो सुश्रीये नमो उच्चमा श्रीये सोह ओ नमो मंजुश्रीये नमो सुश्रीये नमो उच्चमा श्रीये सोह Thank you. So as you're sitting down and just relaxing, getting into the right space, when you're doing prostrations like that, you could, if you wish, I mean, it's quite meritorious, and we're talking about karma and merit. This verse in particular is said to be extremely meritorious, that mantra. And also, if you can't go down, or you don't want to go down, depending on the space available, you can, as you do like this, you can visualize yourself doing full prostrations. You can visualize it. And that's extremely meritorious, extremely. So it's an option, you know, it's an option. And often, you know, when in crowded events, you can see people getting really uptight because they can't do their prostrations. And I mean, Mary knows what I'm talking about, that there's elbowing going on. I mean, there's no need for all that. I mean, basically, if it's tight space, just, you know, you have the respect, you just visualize it. No problem. No problem. Okay. So welcome back. So I'd like to now continue a bit further with karma. So Mary, if you could hand out the 10 virtuous action sheet. Thank you. And I'd like the rest of you to be thinking about what you consider to be virtuous and what you consider to be non-virtuous. Virtues and ethics are virtually the same. You have secular ethics and you have ethics in relation to Dharma. Start to think, are they the same things? If they are, fine. If they're not, how could they possibly be different? Just consider. And within the Dharma, there's ethics, virtuous actions of body. What do you think they are? Virtuous actions of speech and virtuous action of mind. Just consider, what do you think they are? The 10 non-virtues sheet. So you should all have in front of you like this. So just have a look at that. When we talk about virtue in Dharma, we're really talking about taking some control over the three doors. And by the three doors, we're talking about body, speech, and mind. So this is how you start to take control of that. So this is headed 10 virtuous actions. So you can see what the non-virtuous actions are. But these are only 10 within thousands. Buddha highlighted these 10 but in the with the understanding that there are a lot more. So the first three are non-virtue. Well, we'll look at the non-virtue first. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Killing and stealing is very straightforward. Sexual misconduct, well, it takes a lot of study and it takes a lot of thought. I have heard people asking different lamas about sexual misconduct, particularly in relationship to different sexual orientations. And I have heard different lamas give different responses, give very different responses. I know that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, particularly into homosexuality for a while. And his he didn't want to speak about it really, but some of his pronouncements were really not in the positive about homosexuality. Now, he didn't say you don't do it or it's wrong. He just said, karmically speaking, he reckoned it was more of a non-virtue simply because there seems to be more desire, more clinging, more attachment. But here is the rub. There's no real sexual activity that's seen as positive karma. Isn't that interesting? There's actually no sexual activity that's seen as positive. It doesn't have to be negative, but it's not actually seen as positive, which can cause a bit of consternation. However, a lot of the high lamas that I've had teachings from and I've listened to teachings, they have said, really, if you are not harming anyone with your sexual conduct, really, it's you know, reasonable. It's a reasonable activity. But sex, in all its formations, requires desire. It pushes craving. It pushes attachment. And so it's quite hard for this to actually be very positive. Again, I'm not saying it's negative, neither are the teachings, but we tend to defend sexual activity as our human right. And of course. But when you think of sexual desire, the I is very strong. The other individual is seen as solid and inherently so. The craving that goes into that. So because with something like sex, that's quite high, then it's quite hard for that to be positive. It can be, but it's actually quite a difficult one. So hear what I'm saying. I'm not saying that Buddhism says sex is wrong, okay, or you shouldn't, not like that. But if you're going to look at this in virtue and non-virtue, you have to look closely at the sexual activity and its relationship to ignorance, attachment, and aversion, the same as any other action of body, speech, or mind. Now, whenever I say this, sometimes I get kicked back. You said, but, and it was never what I said. So if you need me to clarify this, I will. But I'm trying to make it very clear. Karma is about taking control of the five doors. How do you take control of the five doors? By reducing ignorance, attachment, and aversion. One of the things that we have, desire, that's really strong is sexual activity. Of course. When sexual activity rears its head, what happens? Our desire goes through the roof. Our sense of a strong I is, and a strong I of the other person, the self involved with the other person, very high. It's an activity that overrides everything else. It seems to override everything else. In that moment, it overrides. It's one of the main reasons why they ask monks and nuns, not that they're particularly spiritual. As Lama Zopa Rinpoche often said, monks and nuns really are just people who are trying harder. That's all. Now, if with monks and nuns, there's no sexual activity at all, not at all, in any way, shape, or form. Because why would you be trying harder to control your three doors if you lose it all the time within a sexual activity? And so They're not keen on monks and nuns having sex, basically, not at all. But for that reason, for that reason. So that's the three of the body: killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. The last three are to do with taking control of the mind. And so what you have here is covetousness is a negative activity. And by covetousness, it's very clear that what they're talking about is desiring wrongfully with no regard of the rights of others. Just seeing something and you think, oh, I'd quite like that. I want one of those. Get me Amazon straight away. You know, this is not covetousness. Covetousness is desiring wrongly with no regard to the rights of others. Then you've got malice. And what you're looking at here is a desire to inflict injury or harm on others. There just seems to be within some people this strong wish to inflict harm on other people. That's malice. These people want others to suffer. And wrong views, really, holding wrong views, this is the thing, holding wrong views. Within ethics, Buddhist ethics, this means holding on, although you're practicing Dharma, you're holding on to a belief system that contradicts reality. More than that, you're making no effort to cultivate the correct view of reality. Then you have four of speech. Now that must tell you something. Three of body, three of mind, and four of speech. Which door do we need to guard more closely? Ha ha, speech, of course. So lying. I mean, no shock there. Divisive speech. That's the type of speech that is really your intention is to split people up. Your intention here is to split someone away from something. Either it's a belief, another individual, whatever it is, your intention is to kind of divide. Now, if you say something, you're having a discussion and your opinion tends to be different from the people that you're speaking to, and they then start to think, oh, well, maybe I was thinking wrong. That's not divisive speech. Intention is everything. It's when you intend to divide. Hurtful speech, you have no problem there. Hurtful speech. You have no control over other people's response. You only have control over yourself. But we all know what hurtful speech is. There'll be times when you say something which will hurt people. You must have been in that position. You had no intention to hurt, not at all. But something you said hurt someone. Well, that's not positive. But if you had no intention, then this is very weak. Here we're talking about hurtful speech that people seem to have almost intuitively. You know, that they seem to not just occasionally make a mistake, but they seem to want to hurt with their speech. And they can see the damage it does, but they go ahead. Sometimes with an attitude of, I'm an individual, I can say what I like, it's freedom of speech, and then they go on to be very helpful. No. This is not ethical. freedom of speech, or so-called freedom of speech, however you define it, does not trump looking after people, not hurting, not harmful, not harming in any way. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is often asked, you know, if you're a Buddhist, what is the minimum to be a Buddhist? That's what he's asked this a few times. And he always answers the same way. He says, at least do no harm. At the very least, never harm. So if you're going to be a Buddhist, the very, very least, don't let cultural norms trump these ethics. There are other ways around that. Hurtful speech. Then we've got idle chatter. And what you're looking at here is, it's a bit like gossiping, but it's got a slight taste of putting off doing something meaningful by chatting, you know, by gossiping. You know, you know how you can waste a whole afternoon, and the next thing you know, it's time, you know, the time has flown by. This kind of idle chatter, it's a verbal rumination that just wastes time. It just wastes time. But catching up with people, having the odd bit of gossip, I don't think that's what this means. Rumination of mind. If you've ever looked at your mind, or you've gone for a walk, and the mind just goes on and on and on and on and on and on about nonsense, rumination. The speech can be like that. Speech can be like that. That type of idle chatter. So, doing this is non-virtues. Again, many non-virtues, but these 10 the Buddha highlighted. Now, to make it virtue, you abandon this. You abandon killing. You abandon stealing, etc. Now, here's the thing. To be a virtue, it doesn't mean you just don't do it. Okay? It's like going for a walk after the rain. There's a worm and you just stand on it anyway. Okay? Non-virtue, killing. But you could go out and you're walking along and you step and you just miss killing that worm. That is not virtue. It's not non-virtue, but it isn't virtue. The clue is in the word abandon. It's making a decision not to do something based on its faults. Based on the faults, let's say killing. You don't kill in whatever way, shape, or form because you see the faults of killing. You don't kill because you understand the results of killing in your life, in this life, and future lives. You intend to make an effort to avoid killing. And then you complete the action by refraining from killing. I'm going to say that again. Any one of these 10, simply not doing it is not a virtue. It's not non-virtue, but it's not a virtue. To be a virtue, it has to be abandoned. To abandon it, you have to see the faults of that particular action. You have to believe it's wrong. You have to understand the faults and the result if you did this action. You then make an effort to avoid that particular action. And to complete it all, you actually refrain from that action. Then it becomes a positive karma. And it closes the door on a negative karma. So just think about it. and see if there's any questions or thoughts or comments so far on that. No? Okay. So looking at these 10 non-action, there are different degrees of a complete karma. Okay? There are partial karmas. Let's take killing, for instance. There's a complete karma. You can have a partial karma. So what you're looking at here is that not every act of killing is the same level of negativity. And that makes sense. In order for a full karmic result from, say, killing, there has to be four factors. These factors are called basic, the basis, the intention, the deed, and the completion. Now, the first one, the basis, what that's really saying is there has to be an object that you are working against. So if you stand on a twig thinking you've killed a cockroach, then that doesn't make any sense. Okay? So there has to be an object to which you're acting against. That's the basis. And this is not as silly as it sounds. Many people think they've done lots of these negative things, but when it's looked at, the object that we're meant to be working against either never existed or existed in a way opposite to what you thought. There has to be an object. For instance, in a dream, imagine you're in a dream and you kill someone in a dream. Is there some negative karma? Yes, yes, but very, very slight. It's infinitesimal. The mind moved in a negative way, but there was no control. There was no basis, was there? That person didn't exist. Let's say you sent a letter bomb to someone intending to kill them, but the person wasn't at home and it just blew up in the hallway. There's a lot of negative karma there, yes, but it's not complete because you intended to kill someone and that person wasn't there. So basis is important. The most important is, I think, is that, well, a very heavily important one is the second factor, and that's the factor of intention. Intention. The state of mind you were in. Did you intend to do what you did? Was there recognition of the negativity? What was the motive behind it? Which delusion was flourishing at the time? If you were under the influence, for instance, of alcohol or drugs, and you committed an action, then, you know, if there was no intention, but you did it, then the karma is not complete. You're driving a car and you knock someone down. Perhaps they die. Is this negative karma? Of course. Is it a complete negative karma? No, because you had no intention. The basis was there. The individual was there. They were hit, hurt, and died. But you had no intention to do this. So the karma is not complete. Do you see where I'm going with this? Yeah, you can see what I'm saying. Good. The third factor to bring a full karmic result is the factor of deed. actually performing the action. So you have something against someone. You intend to harm them. You get everything ready to harm them. You get right up to it, and at the very last minute, you do not do it. The deed was not completed. You did not actually perform the action, so it is not a complete karma, and you don't suffer the complete result. Four, the completion of the action. You know what you wanted to do, you intended to do it, the person's in front of you. You perform the action and you complete it. Now, in some texts, the completion is said to be rejoicing. Rejoicing. Not only did I kill you, I'm really glad I did. You deserved it. Many of the texts see that as a kind of completion. So it's like no way back from that. That's a complete karma, a complete karma. Just reflect on that, see if there's any questions about that. So if you have an incomplete karma, do you suffer the results? Yes, of course, but not the complete results. Yes, Gabriel.
So to use your example, if you were to plan to kill someone and you came right up to the moment of doing it and then you decide not to, you're saying that is bad karma.
It's never... Yes, it's bad karma, but not complete.
But then would that not also be a virtuous action because you banned killing?
No.
No.
Because the mind isn't virtuous. Intention is everything, really.
So what's the difference between that and, you know, a situation where you're abandoning killing in a virtuous way?
Okay, so the difference is you intend to abandon killing. So you abandon it, abandon. I will not kill this person because I see the faults, not only my negative karma, but I will hurt them. And my future life will be very difficult and very dangerous, my own life in the future. I will abandon killing this person because I understand the results. I know it's wrong and I understand the results. I intend to make an effort not to kill that person. Or anyone really. And I will, from this day forth, never kill that person. In that way, it becomes positive. It's not just, that's why I started with saying it's just not just doing it. That's not positive. It has to have these pillars around it. Then you take control of the doors. Then you take control of the doors. Thank you, Gabriel. Anyone else? No?
Sorry, can you possibly go through the covetousness again?
Which one do you?
The desiring wrongly with no regards to others. So when you said, you have that nice whatever, I quite like that. Because obviously in daily life you do go around and think, oh, that's, you've got X, Y, and Z, it's quite nice, I like that. Is that with the sort of intention of saying, you know, even if you have no intention of taking it from them, is it just the thought that you like X, Y, and Z, or is it the kind of being envious?
Okay. So first of all, desire is there. Mm. So whatever you're going to do or not do, it's coming from desire and craving. Not a good way to start any positive action. So that's kind of not so good. But when it comes to covetousness, what you're really doing is wishing to deprive, not only that you had this, but you actually desire what that person has so that they don't have it. It's desiring wrongly. Desire is never good. Well, actually, in Tibetan Buddhism, desire is not the big problem. It's attachment. In Theravadin, they say desire. We talk about attachment. But So it's more than, ooh, I'd like that. If I just said this now, I mean, there's a certain thing that I've used at Land of Joy, which I'm saving up for, right? I like it. I don't just like it, I want it, right? And I will save up money. I'm going to put effort into getting this. If my mind is really craving this, really craving, this will never be positive. It'll never be positive. But I'm not. But if I said, I know that person has that, I should have that, they don't need it as much as I need it. I want that. That's the difference. That's covetousness. That's wrongly desiring with no regard to the rights of others. Thanks, Anna. Anyone else? No? Okay, so let's look at, I mean, it is fairly straightforward. It's quite good to do a bit of extra work on the four factors. That's very helpful because, you know, people can get a bit wound up about negative karma, thinking it's a complete karma when in fact it wasn't. And you get very sensitive people who had no intention of doing various things, but on reflection, they did them and then they get upset. But if there was no intention, it's like taking the air out of the tires. You know, it's like there is a negativity there, but it is very small, really, very small. And told you I worked in prisons and other people have done, I know, but working with some of the murderers, you know, they get to this stage, they're not happy. I'm not happy at this stage, you know. One young man, I didn't know him. I mean, I knew he'd murdered someone, but I didn't know. And literally, he stalked this person, stalked them for days. Then he imprisoned him in a shed, tortured him, killed him, and laughed about it. He wasn't under any undue influence. So he said to me, do you think that was heavily negative?
Oh,
what do you say? I said, well, how come you're in for such a long time? You've got a very big sentence. He said, yeah. He says, I should never have cut him up. So he ended up cutting this person up and distributing body parts. So there's extremes at both ends, ladies and gentlemen, extremes at both ends. So let's look at the effects of virtuous actions. Now, this is something that you can do some study on. But when you perform virtues, it's not just, I've said to you before, any karmic action, you do have kind of an immediate result. But the mind remembers that. And when circumstances surrounding this are similar, it causes that to flourish. So that type of result can throw you into different realms of existence at the time of death. If it's a complete karma, it can. If that ripens at the time of death, that could throw you into a hell realm, into an animal realm. Any of the realms that are corresponding to the cause that you had. If you kill, the chances are that your life will be short. If you take a vow not to kill, to abandon killing and all that, then that tends to lead to a longer life, perhaps in this lifetime, but more often next lifetime. So when the lamas see people who are living a long time, they say, you must have been very virtuous in your last life. You abandon killing, and that's a fruit. It's called a fruit. Now, you look at the effects of virtuous actions as you will experience in future lives, or if you're lucky in this life, results very similar to the cause. So if you've been killing, you steal, you denigrate someone, then it happens to you. It just rebounds right back on you. Rebounds right back on you. But also, if you have this type of negativity on your mind stream, when it ripens, the chances are you will commit the result. You will commit that action again. That type of habit is hard to shake. the chances are you commit the action again. There are also environmental effects, and you can look at this because it's very specific. When you start studying this, you can take each one of these 10, and they are very specific fruits, very specific results, what type of hell realm you go into, whatever. But the environment you find yourself in. This is why the Buddha says, if you want to see what type of life you have led in the past lives, look at who you are now. Look at your environment and how the environment is peopled and how you live within. That's a very good indication of how you lived a past life. If you want to know what your future lives are going to be, have a look at your mind, especially in relation to these known virtues. So there's lots of different results of different types of karma. And that's something that's worth, if we had a longer time, we could take each one and look at it. But I think once you get the idea, then it's easier read, I think, and studied. But if I was doing a weekend on it, we'd go each one of these. So do you understand? When you do the particular actions, it's not just immediate. On the mind stream, there is a potential now. And when you meet the right causes and conditions and that flourish, that could be, especially if it's a whole karma, if that ripens at the time of death, it throws you into a different realm of existence and it will not be positive. You can have an effect that corresponds to the cause. You can have a short life. Or if you've abandoned a particular action such as killing, you can have a longer life. In future lives, you tend to experience what you've put in action. So if you've been stealing or you've been killing, the chances are you will be harmed by others and people will steal from you a lot. I mean, you must have met people, I hope, that can never hold on to anything. Especially when I was traveling, I kept finding people, they lost this, they lost that, they had this stolen from them, you know, amazing. Amazing. Continuously. This is definitely karma ripening in this way. And there's always an environmental cause. We have created the cause to live in the environment we have now. We've created lots of positive karma to be living in the environment we have now. I don't care how difficult your life is. You're not in the middle of a war zone. You really are in the middle of an environment that's very positive to you. So that's good karma flourishing. The next heading there is the determining power of the vows taken. In Buddha Dharma, there is a power behind taking a vow. There's a difference between saying, right, I'm not going to kill. And that's positive. If you abandon it and all because of its causes, etc. But the person who says, not only will I not kill, I take a vow in this lifetime. I will never kill, ever. Now, the merit involved with that is much higher. It's like making quite a strong promise and keeping that promise. So the power of a vow, if kept, is very, very positive. If you take the vow and you break it, then the negativity is very strong. However, there is such a thing as purifications. You can purify negative karma. And there's ways and means of doing that. So taking any vow, you need to cherish any vow you've taken. If you do, they say the progress is very rapid. Any comments on that? Bina?
Just wanted to ask about karma.
About?
Karma.
Karma.
Mm-hmm. Is the karma experienced in your state of mind? Is it how you experience your... Is it the state of mind that in which the...
in which karma is experienced rather than the environmental circumstances.
Okay.
Because different people experience different environmental circumstances.
I understand. Karma is not the result. Karma is action. We talk about karma being cause and effect. It is not. It's cause. It's action. There is an effect of karma, but it's not karma. It's the effect of karma. Karma itself is active. It's a cause. It's an intention. Generally speaking, people say it's cause and effect. No, it's not. It's simply cause. But there is an effect of karma, which can be environmental, for sure. But it's not karma. People say that. You do something wrong or something negative happened, they go, that's karma. And you know what they're saying? It's nonsense. It's not karma. It's the result of karma. So they're judging you on something you've done in the past, which results in you suffering now. But it's not karma. It's the effect. And that is different. Thank you, Vina. That's I should have made that clear earlier. Thank you for that, because I might have forgotten to say, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Have a look, please, at the bottom line, which says throwing karma and completion karma, completing karma. What are they talking about here? Well, there's many different types of karma, but there's a type of karma called a throwing karma, sometimes called a projecting karma. This is the karma that ripens at the time of death and throws you into your next life. How you die is quite important. Having a calm mind, a non-agitated mind, is important because karma is ripening all the time. So a projecting karma is a complete karma. It's a complete karma, not partial. And when that ripens at the time of death, that's what throws you into whatever lifestyle, not lifestyle, whatever realm of existence that corresponds to that particular karma. That type of karma is heavenly influenced as a craving for existence. Right within that, there's a craving for existence. This particular karma is highly active just before death, but it is operating all the time, not just then. It is operating. It will operate on and off throughout your life, but at the time of death, this becomes very important. If someone is dying, you don't agitate them. You just don't do that. You do whatever you can to please the five senses of that individual. No loud noises, no banging, nothing that irritates, so that they die calmly. You don't want to irritate someone, and then that's the karma that triggers the completion karma on the mind. And then that throwing karma, they could end up maybe not in a very nice realm of existence. Remember, when we're talking about karma, it can seem quite out of this world, really. But look what you're saying here. What is the driving principle, the creative principle in Buddhism? It's not God. It's not God being angry with you or God thinking you're a very nice person, we're going to do something for you. It's not that. It's karma. Karma itself is the creative principle. So it has this power. It has this power, especially at the time of death, projecting karma, throwing karma. The other type of karma you'll hear about in study is called completing karma. Completing karma is karma that ripens and is related to the quality of life and the quality of experiences you have in this life. Called completing karma. And completing karma and throwing karma, they work together. And I remember Geshe Tashi saying, be careful of these two karmas, because projecting or throwing karma and completing karma, they work together, and it brings about who we actually are. It becomes who you are. It dictates our physical, our mental states, our constituents' body. It helps to construct our personality, our traits. This is the combination of these two types of karma. So again, just think about it, reflect on it, do a bit more study. And the next time you read about it, it will be a bit easier. So these are some of the areas you want to look at in relation to karma, for sure. Could you hand out, Mary, the characteristics one? It is quite a few facts I'm giving you, but these are basic facts. It can get more complicated, but at the moment. So you should have this handout, general characteristics. Again, I've written it like this so you can add to it in your study. The first one says the result of actions are definite. That's important. If you create the cause, you will experience the result, unless you purify. The thing to understand is there is a fixed relationship between cause and effect. It's fixed. So the result will always bear a strong resemblance to the cause. There's a fixed relationship here. The second bit says the results of actions increase. Well, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse. Karma doesn't stick on the mind in the same state that it landed. Karma increases. It grows. So small negative karmas can grow into, by the time it flourishes and you experience it, can actually be quite heavy. The smallest positive karma you put on your mind stream can flourish. And when you experience it, it's grown so much, it becomes the best thing that ever happened to you in that life. It increases. Karma is not static. Unless you apply an opponent power, applying opponent powers, purification, can stop the growth of karma, keep it as it is. And if you do it well enough, you can actually get rid of that karma. It can be purified. It can be halted so it doesn't grow anymore. And it can be purified if done well. So the results of actions increase. This is important. So we say in this life, don't sweat the small stuff. We say that, right? In Dharma, sweat the small stuff. Just sweat it. Don't do it. However tiny, however insignificant it is, however you think it's justified, don't do it. Abandon, remember the prayer, abandon all negative actions. Perform only precious, virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Remember that verse? This is what we're talking about. This is exactly what we're talking about. When something negative happens to us, our tendency is to say, why me? I never did anything to deserve this. We either do that or we say it's your fault. It's that person's fault. It's the environment's fault. It's all. No. Not like that. Not like that. Number three, if an action is not performed, its result cannot be experienced. Now, you could sort of say, well, of course, why even bother putting that in? But what we need to grasp here is there is no, if this, we're talking about cause and effect here. Well, yeah, we're talking about cause and effect here. If there is no cause, there's no effect. If there is an effect, there was a cause. So you can't say, it's not my fault. You can't say, I don't know how this happened. You can't even say, why aren't I experiencing this? Why can't I have this? Why is this? If you haven't created the cause, you will not have the result. So this is why this is actually quite important. If an action is not performed, you can't experience a result. If you want to have people be generous to you, if you want to have a life where you're not worried about possessions, that you have enough, then you have to have had actions in the past where you were very generous, or even just slightly generous, but you were generous kind of regularly. If you don't have the resources you need, and that's going on for a while, then the action wasn't performed that would give you the resources here. So you look at how you're living. Why can't I get what I want? Well, I didn't create the cause. Better start now. Yeah, like that. Like that. An action is never wasted. We tend, if we've done something negative, generally speaking, people will say, look, you didn't mean it, just forget about it. Just move on, step beyond that, you'll be fine. Right? That's what we think. Not in Dharma. There is no action that's ever wasted. It's all, the mind records all of it. It's there. It's never wasted. And so it makes sense then. If you don't want the result, you purify. You purify. But whatever you've done, if you've done something and you've never revisited it in your mind, and you kind of, I'm just going to move on now because I'm a better, whatever. It's not wasted. Karma's not like that. Karma's not like that. It's never wasted. But it can be purified. Any questions about that? Gabriel?
So this is a kind of law of cause and effect.
Yeah, well, I'm going to come on to that, but cause and effect is involved.
Okay, yeah. And then there's also a kind of, I suppose, what you might call a conventional idea of cause and effect. So, for you know, if I steal something from someone, they'll be angry at me, or if I go to work, I'll earn money. So what I'm wondering is karma a deeper truth? Is the other cause and effect just illusory? Is it not real? Or is this like an extension of that kind of cause and effect? Does that make sense?
Okay, I'm going to come on to that, but I'll answer it now. There is a difference between cause and effect and karma. You can say all karma is cause and effect, but not all cause and effect is karma. And that's important. So within Buddha Dharma, there's what's called the four principles. The four principles. We talked about the four seals earlier, but there's four principles. These four principles, the first one is, the fact is, the first principle is that things exist and causes lead to effects. That's the first principle. Things exist and causes lead to effect. The second principle is called the principle of efficacy. And it is that things have a capacity to produce certain results according to their nature. So the first principle is really the principle of nature, the principle of nature. Things exist and causes lead to effect. So let's go back to that first one. Again, His Holiness, I wasn't there, but I have seen it on tape. When people were asking about various things about karma and this, that, and the next thing, and people started asking about, well, what about the weather and tsunamis and things that do this? Why does that happen? And he said, that's just the way things are, dear. It's cause and effect. It is cause and effect. It's not karma. So that first principle of nature is the fact that things exist and causes lead to effect. The second principle is things have the capacity to produce a certain results according to their own nature. The third principle is called the principle of dependency. And what it means is if the first two are active, and they are, there is a natural dependency, a natural link between the two. Things and events, causes and effects. You can look this up anyway. It's called the four principles. The fourth principle is called the principle of valid proof. And what it means is, given this, that must be the cause. Given that, this should be the cause. It's called the four principles. This is cause and effect that's running right through our life. So when does cause and effect become karma? So all cause and effect is not karma, but karma is cause and effect. What's the factor? The factor involved there is feeling. And I'll go into that a wee bit later. But as soon as your feelings become involved, karma operates. It's raining. Cause and effect. I don't like the fact it's raining. Karma. Okay? You're welcome. I may have to repeat that later on because I've got my notes and everything. Anyway, so here we go. We're now looking at the factors and severity. Now, even if it's a complete action, there is severity increases or decreases depending on certain things, certain factors. So first of all, you've got the nature of the action. The heavier the nature of the action, such as killing. Right? Such as killing. And even killing. If you kill your father or your mother, that's much heavier than killing a stranger. You see, in Christianity, often killing is killing. Not in karma. Killing is killing, but far more severe. If you kill the person that gave you birth, if you kill the person who has nurtured you and helped to keep you to grow into an adult, if you kill a Buddha, an Arhat, a Bodhisattva, someone that has the capacity to help so many people, then heavier. If you kill someone who has been very beneficial to you, it's much heavier. So the nature of the action becomes important. Number two, the intention. Well, that we've said this before, but this is still in relation to severity. There is a delusion working here, and the intention does move the mind to the object. However, there are different intentions, different levels of intention. Karma is action. So how strong was that intention? The method involved, up close and personal, heavier karma. Killing from a distance, they say, less karma. I think it depends how much, I mean, to stab someone takes a lot more negativity than, say, to sit behind a drone and kill someone. Do you see there's a big difference there? And so they say the method you involve certainly affects how heavy, how severe that karma is. The object or the basis of the action, well, is again, someone that's helped you, your mother, your father, an arhat, a bodhisattva. So, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. And how often the karma is committed. Sometimes I wonder if this is related to the increase in karma on the mind stream, keeping nurturing negative karma. But you get people who habitually steal. You get people who habitually lie. You get people who habitually cause trouble. And they'll say to you, I didn't mean any of that. But how often you commit the karma, how often you commit the action increases the severity. We're picking this apart, and we've not picked it apart to a huge depth, but we're picking it apart. Why is there so much ifs and buts? Because this is the causal factor in our lives. This is what drives us. We pick it apart to the minutest detail in order to deal with it. A big overview saying, well, just don't do anything wrong and just do things right. You'll be fine. No, we're talking about the closest we have to a creative principle. You need to know how it functions in order to identify it and correct it. Work with it. The last point there, point six, is the application or non-application of a component power. And so what it's saying here is that if you apply an opponent power, and there's meditations you can do that are opponent powers, you can mitigate that karma. You can lessen it. You can halt it from increasing. And if it's done well and often enough, you can actually eliminate negative karma. To be done properly, in your meditation, four things have got to be present. One, deep regret. I am not talking about crying. I am not talking about heavy emotion and someone sobbing in the corner. I'm talking about a deep regret for having done something so foolish. The second part of that would be taking strong refuge. Strong refuge in something that's stronger than yourself. You can't take refuge in yourself, but my own teacher, Lama Yeshe, used to teach purification in monasteries and in convents. And they took refuge in Our Lady, they took refuge in Jesus or God, and he taught the same thing because it affects the mind. If you're a Buddhist, your refuge is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The third point of any purification is you apply a strong opponent power. You apply a remedy. What are you going to do to counteract what you did? It could be something physical. It could be something verbal. Or it can be a particular type of meditation that's tailored to counteracting that negativity. And the fourth point, if you are going to purify, your fourth point is having a strong resolve. When you finish all that in your meditation, you sit down and you make a strong resolve. I will not do that again. If you're sensible, you'll give yourself a time limit. This is how we were taught. Give yourself a time limit. You could say, it's possible, you could say, I will never again do this in this lifetime. If you feel you can do that, very good. But you could easily say, I will not commit this, especially if you're habitual. You have a habitual problem. I will not do this for a week. If you keep that promise, the purification is there. You could say, I will not do this for a day, 24 hours. The purification is there. So you could choose a time limit. Recently, I've heard some teachings on purifications and they didn't mention a time limit. Don't know. I certainly was taught a time limit. Because otherwise you say, I'll never do that again. Of course, if you've got a habit, of course you're going to do it again. You don't want to, but if it's a habit. So to help the mind focus, sometimes very helpful to give yourself a time limit. It makes sure that you're watching your mind carefully. You're watching your mind carefully. There is a handout that Mary will give you at the end of this session. It has those 4 points there. And you can use that in your research. And there's certain purification practices you can learn, very useful. And then if you're really up for it, you can do a 3-month purification retreat up in the mountains, and you're doing nothing but purification. Always fun. So on this handout, again, I'm trying to give you a straightforward way through of studying this. Is there anything on here you want to comment on or question? Okay. Good.
I've got a question, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Just on the last point about purification.
Yep.
Deep regret.
Yep.
If you're trying to apply deep regret to, if one hypothetically accepts that you're experiencing an effect because of something that's happened in your previous life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have to have the faith, don't you, that you will have done that in a previous life. But if you don't have that faith.
I would say understanding, but faith is okay at the moment.
How do you?
Oh, you don't?
Is there a way around?
No.
No.
Not really.
Is there a way of achieving the deep regret? I don't know. Is there another way of doing it?
I don't know. Maybe I'm too literal. But if you have no faith, in what this, I'm not saying this is negative. You either do or you don't. I mean, you know, but if you have no belief in past lives, this makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense, because not everything that you do, according to Buddha Dharma, in this life, you experience in this life. More often than not, your experience is in the next life. The way karma works. You know, you can have a 99-year-old man who's done nothing but evil all his life, has lived a wonderful, rich, exciting life. He's 99 years old. He's on the golf course. He's just done a hole in one. He's got his arm round a blonde and he drops down dead, right? There is nothing in this guy's life that you could say that he's done wrong. Where is the result of what he did wrong? Where is it? All he's had is a wonderful life. There's never been a moment. So how can you think karma even acts this way? Karma doesn't act this way. Karma can act in this life. It's rare, but it can. But it tends to happen more in lives to come. This is not a promise of life to come, like do things nice and you'll end up in heaven.